Hello and welcome to Tigers by the Fire, a podcast out of Holy Cross High School about World War II discussions and stories. With me today is Cameron Callahan.
Hi, I'm Cameron.
Aaron Guichard.
Hello.
And Luke Suggs.
Hello, my name is Luke Suggs.
And today we're going to be talking about, well, they titled it Glide to Glory, and we're looking at the glider regiments that participated in the war in Europe, mostly operating during D-Day, but also a number of other operations that they're going to discuss. And this is a really cool topic because I feel like it is one that in a normal history class, like if you were taking U.S. history, you may never talk about this at all, and it's not something you would really know about unless you do some research. And so I'm going to let them really kind of take this under their wing or under their glider, if you will, and I'm going to give it off to Cameron Callahan.
Thank you. So we just wanted to start by explaining why we chose the format that we will be presenting this podcast. We think that we could give a gross overview of the glider regiment as a whole, but rather we chose to use the format of personal accounts to really encapsulate the feelings of the regiment, of the personal stories that these people experience. We thought that that's one of the most interesting parts about learning about World War II is, of course, the actual events are important and interesting, but the personal accounts from the people that actually experience these events is more interesting in our opinion.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point that you make there, Cameron. And I know one of the books that we use, which is The Story of World War II by Donald Miller, really does that a lot. Obviously, as a class, we go to the World War II Museum, and in each of those exhibits, it's personal narratives that really make it jump out to you. So I'm glad you guys chose to use that kind of a format. So I think that's really cool. Very creative.
So we're going to I'm going to give like an overall context, what this specific regiment did. It is the 325th Glider Infantry Regiment of the 82nd Infantry Division. So actually, fun fact, on March 25th, 1942, the regiment formed under the command of Colonel Claudius Easley at Camp Claiborne, Louisiana, where we are, the school, Holy Cross School, is currently in Louisiana. After the initial training, the regiment was reorganized as a glider infantry unit when the 82nd Infantry Division was reorganized as the 82nd Airborne Division in August 1942, and the 325th was redesignated as the 325th Glider Infantry Regiment. So I kind of want to start off by saying, like, the life of a glider rider, as it was not easy. The gliders themselves were made out of plywood and had no armored protection for the troopers riding inside. The weight of the gliders, due to it being plywood, was obviously pretty heavy, so it would go down pretty fast, and with little control by the pilots. So in kind of essence, the glider's sole purpose was to crash, hopefully somewhat gently, any sort of geographical obstacle like a tree or bushes could be pretty harmful and obviously serious danger for the troopers inside. So as the 325th trained to go to war in Europe, Colonel Harry Lewis would eventually take over command. They would first see combat in Salerno, Italy. On September 15th, 1943, the 325th would board landing craft and arrive by sea in Salerno. They would board a landing craft again and land further north to relieve Colonel William O'Darby's Rangers on Mount St. Angelo di Cava. They actually received their first unit citation for this event because as they saved Colonel William O'Darby's Rangers, so they actually received their first out of two unit citations, and we'll talk about what a unit citation is later on.
That's pretty neat that the first times they're actually in operation, they're not gliding in, it's landing just like a normal soldier, which is, it's kind of interesting because it shows you that the Army still hadn't quite developed this this method yet, and it's going to take another year for them to really get on that. So,
okay.
So following their combat in Italy, the 325th was sent to England to begin preparation for Operation Overlord. Actually, a large portion of their casualties, the regiment's casualties, were due to obstacles known as Rommel's asparagus. And if you don't know, Rommel's asparagus are telephone poles topped with mines placed in landing fields. To me, that sounds pretty like harsh if you're gliding down and you see a telephone pole with a mine on top of it. It's pretty crazy.
So one of the things, and I'll point this out, and I know two of you are going to go to these areas with me in the spring. You know, Normandy is a series of farm fields. It's like the Wisconsin of France. If you kind of look at it, it's just rolling fields. And what Rommel does is they set up these telephone poles, and they're not like huge, not that far up. But like you said before, what are these gliders made out of? Plywood. So that the mines don't even do that much. It's actually when they land, they'll run into it and it rips the gliders apart. And then when the telephone pole falls, the mine explodes. And so it didn't even need the mines, to be honest. If they hit any obstacle, these things break apart very, very easily. And it's the Rommel's asparagus thing were terrifying to these. And that's, like you said, that's the majority of the casualties that took place there. So very good job.
So the 325th joined the battle at La Fère Causeway, which would later be known as the bloodiest small unit engagement of the war. This battle was a 4-day battle, which was proved vital for the United States and allies because it would eventually let troops from the Utah Beach pursue inland. After the June 16th, the unit was sent back to England to rearm, regroup, reorganize for their next operation. This next operation was Operation Market Garden, which was the largest airborne operation in the history of the warfare. For this operation, the 325th was tasked with capturing bridges to the south of the Nijmegen Bridge. The regiment was able to help the tired and overworked paratroopers of the 82nd beat off German attacks, earning them a second Distinguished Unit Citation. So like I said before, they got their first one at Mount St. Angelo de Cava, and they got their second one. And these Distinguished Unit Citations are awarded to units of the uniformed services of the United States and those of allied countries for extraordinary heroism in action against an armed enemy on or after December 7th, 1941.
And what's cool about the things that Aaron just pointed out is most people, like I said, don't know much about glider pilots at all, or soldiers that they don't even really know much about gliders. But clearly they're involved at D-Day. The Battle of La Fère Causeway or La Fère Bridge, it has over 250 Allied casualties. It is a huge stand by airborne soldiers against three German tanks and a couple of hundred German soldiers coming at them to take this bridge, and they hold it for a couple of days. It's really an amazing story. Market Garden is one of the largest operations of the war. It's a British plan. It failed, but they're actually heroes at that, and they do help out the, like you said, the 82nd Airborne in there. And so, I mean, these are two of the biggest things of 1944, and they're right there. They're right there in the scuffle. And I know now we're going to go into some firsthand accounts. Is that the plan?
Yes.
Awesome. Awesome.
So I'm actually going to start it off with some of the accounts, gliding right on in. We got Lewis Moon up first. He was one of the people who was a part of this glider regiment, and I think I would classify this as a very experimental group. You know, these people were coming in with basic training and basic experience, and they were joining, you know, this group of glider infantry with, you know, plywood. It wasn't something that was very secure. So Lewis Moon, his accounts mainly consist of his feelings during this time. He said he's a guy from Texas, so when he got moved to England, it was a very big change for him. He's quote unquote saying he thought of his wife and kids all the time. He was very homesick. And this kind of sets up the stage for what most of these soldiers were feeling at the time. They had no idea what they were getting into, and it kind of adds to the brutality, as you were talking about, with the gliders coming in and crashing every time that they would land. And when they did glide in, they glided into Holland. So this guy was after Normandy, and he says it's a feeling that makes you feel that they are as cruel as the pictures show. So he's describing the soldiers that were shot, that were shooting at them when they were gliding down. He did end up landing perfectly, but he said many of the others around him crash landed, and it didn't look too good. Moving on, we have another account, Tommy Uzel. So this guy kind of going off of the inexperience, he was drafted. He did not volunteer. So, he really didn't want to be in the army. But he was drafted. He moved around a lot. He was shipped to Baltimore, processed overseas, and then moved to New York and then on to England. The conditions there were not good, as he is quoted by saying they slept on mud and on coats. And then a few weeks later, he flew down to Belgium for the Battle of the Bulge. And during this time, they were actually captured, and they were surrounded by Germans. So they had to get sent help. He had frostbite, and which was obviously something that is very, very damaging to obviously physical pain and mental pain. And so he was then... he was then sent back, and then so that's kind of like his first experiences in the war. And then by the time he got into the glider infantry, he describes the gliders as being torn up and hit by gunfire. Again, this just shows how bad of a condition they really were. But what's most interesting about this account is his life after the war. He was awarded a numerous number of medals, the Good Conduct Medal, Purple Heart, Bronze Indian Arrowhead Medal, and the World War II Victory Medal. And he was discharged on January 19th, 1946 in Mississippi. What I find most interesting about this account is that his life after the war was just a very normal life. He, you know, went from getting frostbite, being involved in these gliders, and then all of a sudden he goes back to his normal life. He was married at 22, became a commercial fisherman. He worked at an ammo plant in Louisiana for 20 years. He was a carpenter and served in the police jury for 25 years, and ended up having 5 children and a really big family with over 9 grandchildren, if I believe.
So he ends up having just a normal life. But as a 19-20-year-old, he is thrown into, like you said, his first combat was, you said, the Battle of the Bulge, which is the most violent battle in the history of the U.S. Army. And then, you know, after the war, he gets to go home and, you know, lives a very normal life from someone from Mississippi, Louisiana, right? So I always find that to be kind of interesting that these people were able to come home and actually live their life after they see all of these things at an age that's right around where you guys are. You know, they're talking maybe a year or two older than you. So I think that's always kind of neat.
Yes. He was extremely, extremely lucky to survive and especially be able to live a normal life. And my last account is Lester Swarm and Dallas Griffin. This is a double whammy, a parallel of two soldiers. As the first account mentions, his homesick from his family and the sights that he saw. And then the second one is more dealing with after his life or after his time in the war. This one is a relationship between two soldiers. So they both arrived at Fort Bragg in North Carolina in December of 1942. They went through basic training together. They are placed in the heavy weapon company. You know, they get to work on different guns. Dallas worked on machine guns. Lester was a different type of gun. And then they were so then after that, on February 12th of 1943, the 322nd was taken out and replaced. So this brings in the 325, and they arrived in Nebraska in March of 1943. After this, they were moved around a lot, you know, going from Fort Bragg, they marched to Camp McCall, 50 miles on foot, and then they began more training in April of 1944. At this point, they hadn't really known each other. They were just around the same area, but they didn't know who each other were. And later, in June 1944, they arrived in Liverpool, England, and they lost track of each other at camp. And And then both of them were sent back to finish parachute training as a part of the 82nd Regiment. So then by this time, when they were going through parachute training, this is when they really started to create a bond with each other. You know, they have accounts of them passing each other, patting each other on the back, saying things like, "We made it this far," kind of starting to build that camaraderie. And then they trained for the invasion of Berlin in France together. And then on December 16th, 1944, Hitler changed his plans. And this meant that they were ordered to go to Ardennes, is it?
Yeah, the Ardennes. It's the Battle of the Bulge.
The Battle of the Bulge. So, you know, they were supposed to go there. Or they did go there, and they were online from December 18th to January 10th. So a pretty decent amount of time. And after that, they were housed in a cotton mill factory after being relieved. And this was the first time they saw each other since France. They shared stories of a buzz bomb that didn't go off, that if it did go off, they both would have died. And they realized that they had a very strong bond with each other, that is something that couldn't be made anywhere else outside of this special group. And it's kind of interesting to see how they went through so many things together, but they kind of saw each other and then they didn't. And then they kind of reconnected towards the end. Dallas did end up dying in 1945 in December, but Lester lived to tell the tale. And there's a quote that I found. It's, "In heaven, there has to be a special place for all airborne troopers." So this quote kind of shows that these people were a very special group of people. And it kind of, again, highlights the camaraderie between these two men.
And, you know, I'm going to bring up just some side stuff to put context in this. The airborne encompasses, obviously, soldiers who jump out of planes with paratroopers. It also incorporates the glider soldiers. And sometimes, as the war went on, they got cross-trained and they did various things and they would switch up on what they were doing. But above all that, they get put in the hardest situations. And so you talk about these guys getting thrown into the Ardennes Forest December 15th. They're not given winter clothing. They're given very little ammunition, very little food. And so they're going to be on the front lines of this. And this is the final push for Germany to try and somehow win the war. And so it's everything Germany has. And I think that's really neat to point that out. And then you find these relationships with these guys because they go through these training and their training is hard. They're jumping out of airplanes. They're gliding down. I mean, this is not easy stuff. And they do form these bonds that stick with them for the rest of their lives. And they do have these stories. The buzz bomb story, I have heard that one before. And there are a couple of different stories like that where bombs land and then they don't go off, or artillery shells land right in front of people and they don't go off. So I always like those kind of accounts. But I wanted to point out just that these guys are all associated like this, where they trained very hard and they form these relationships. And I know we have a couple of guys is this Aaron or Cameron?
It'll be me. Ooh. So my first guy is Leonard Weinstein. A firsthand account by Leonard Weinstein. He was stationed in France and he was on guard duty at the regimental stockade. When he was on his sleep break, he was woken up by a prisoner of the stockade. He noticed that the prisoner and himself were the only ones in the tent where he was sleeping. He also noticed that there was nobody on guard duty. Nobody was watching over. This guy could have easily escaped, but rather than escaping, he woke Weinstein up, asked him to grab his rifle and follow him to the bathroom so he could use the restroom. And that's just one of those stories where it's the what ifs, right? Like the hypotheticals of like what could have happened. Weinstein had a rifle right next to him. The prisoner could have taken the rifle and killed him. And I think that story really just like highlights how interesting it is learning about these firsthand accounts from World War II, is that all these different things could have happened, but this is just the way the story went. And yeah, so I thought that one was very interesting. And then my second firsthand account is from Walter Wentz. After he died in 2001, his wife sent the author of the book that we use for these firsthand accounts. It's called Glide to Glory. Walter Wentz's wife sent the author a poem that he wrote while he was in Africa. And reading the poem, it really just brings the humanity to the situation. It shows that these soldiers were not killing machines, right? They were real people. Most of them were around our age, 18, 19 years old. So it really puts into perspective. So I will read a little bit of it. Somewhere in North Africa, where the sun is like a curse and each long day is followed by another one worse, where you see a lot of Arabs and sleep in a slit trench, where you can't understand the people for they all speak in French. Somewhere in North Africa, where a woman is never seen, where the sky is never cloudy and the grass is seldom green, where the roaring bombers rob you of all your sleep, where the once proud German was seen to make his last sweep. Somewhere in North Africa, where the nights are made for love, where the moon is like a searchlight with the Southern Cross above, that shines like a diamond on a balmy tropic night. What a shameful waste of beauty when there's not a girl in sight. So something like that, it just shows that these were still people, right? They still had emotions, and it was interesting to see a poem, because when you think about people fighting in a war, you don't think about poetry. Poetry usually isn't the first thing that pops into your mind, but it was still there for these soldiers to think about the humanity of the situation.
Yeah, one of the things we're going to look at in the second semester of the course is some of these coping mechanisms, and poetry is obviously one that a lot of guys use. You guys actually saw some of that when we saw the Disney exhibit. We saw some people who used drawing as a coping mechanism. Very, very common. But the poetry one, I think, is always interesting. And we're going to read from some interesting accounts as we go forward about, you know, the way in which people depict what they're seeing. And that's how you're right. That's how he was able to process all of the craziness that was going on. And some of it's beautiful, some of it's dark, some of it can be, you know, depressing, some of it can be joyous, but it's just, it's a natural human coping mechanism. So I'm glad you brought, that's a different perspective too than we've seen.
So my first account is from a guy named Gilbert Esquire. He participated in the Normandy invasion, the Battle of Ardennes, Rhineland, Central Europe, and Anzio. So his kind of account kind of displays a story of how his experiences through his shipment to Europe and how much he hated the sea, as we'll see. But he boarded a ship heading to Italy. It was one of the largest convoy to ever sail out of the U.S. prior to the Normandy invasion. So he talks about his nights on the ship. The first couple of nights, the troops were actually asked to stay in the bottom of the ship, so enemy spies did not know the troops were in the ship. To me, I never knew about that they did that, but that was kind of interesting to me. One night, he sneaks up to the top of the deck of his ship and looks out and just sees the pure amazement of all the ships sailing towards hell. That's what he said, sailing towards hell. He got out on the top of the deck. It was like the horizon, the sun was setting, and just to look at all the ships heading towards, I mean, hell, pretty much. They're going to Europe to fight for their country. So around night 4 and 5, the other troops, including himself, start to feel really seasick. This would cause a huge problem because they slept on bunk beds, right? And they had, so if you were sick and you were on the top bunk, they would often throw up, and it would trickle down to the person on the bottom bunk. But also, you wouldn't want to. So that's why you wouldn't really want to sleep on the bottom bunk. But you didn't really want to sleep on the top bunk because heat air rises, and it would be very uncomfortable during sleep. So just the overall experience of in those ships were very uncomfortable. They would actually sometimes even put safety ropes on the soldiers during sleep due to the choppy waves. They would move around apparently a lot. So they would need to put safety rope. On the 10th night, German submarine wolf packs attacked slower moving vessels. So I'm assuming they were German U-boats that were obviously in a pact, and they would pick off the slower moving vessels. That was kind of a rude awakening for the crew as crazy gunfire was going off. But he said, thankfully, the American naval escort of warships and submarines were always on alert, and they helped them attack the German U-boats. Finally, they did eventually get to Italy, and he was transported to Scraptoft, England, where he started training for Operation Overlord. But I thought this was always like an interesting account because you never really hear about like what the personal issues goes on like in a ship, and like how much people actually got seasick, and you wouldn't think of that. And I kind of thought the German submarine wolf packs, like, that was interesting. I never heard that term before, of them calling the submarine being called wolf packs that attack slower moving vessels.
Yeah, the Germans, they could only attack in certain areas of the Atlantic. And so they would wait until about halfway through the journey, because Americans would use air cover from the States. And then when you got close to England, they'd use air cover from England to patrol the water, because you can see the outline of a U-boat. It has to surface to a certain level before it can fire. And so when they were in this like soft zone, where the dark zones where they couldn't necessarily see it, the U-boats would attack, and the Allies traveled in convoys. And so it's these big groupings of ships that would be essentially flanked by warships, destroyers and cruisers and everything else. And it's really crazy. And you have to, you know, if these soldiers are packed like sardines on these ships with their closest friends and probably not friends, and a lot of guys are getting sick, they're in these overcrowded things. And then there's the factor of, yeah, halfway through, all of a sudden everyone's on alert and you're hearing gunfire and you can't do anything about it. So that had to be nerve wracking. And it's pretty, there's actually a movie that came out. I forget the name of it. It came out like 2 or 3 years ago with Tom Hanks, and it's on Apple TV, but it's, honestly, it's about this. It's actually about one ship's run across the Atlantic going against these wolf packs. It's pretty neat. Worth checking out, if I could actually remember the name of it. But it's pretty good. Greyhound is the name. Greyhound is the name of the movie. So, no, that's again, I'm glad you guys really did a good job of picking out like different types of accounts. I mean, we've seen some combat accounts, obviously some poetry. Now we got traveling over. So very good.
And this second account was kind of, I think, the best one here. His name was Marion White. He had a pretty interesting story, pretty funny story, actually. So he and his high school friend thought that or knew that they were going to get drafted eventually. So they enlisted because they thought the enlisted were supposed to get, you know, better treatment than the draftees, because, you know, you actually wanted to go fight. Obviously, probably that wasn't the case, I'm assuming. But he was born in Iowa. He was sent to Camp Walters, Texas for basic training. Then he became a Coast Guard between San Diego and Los Angeles. And during his Coast Guard years, he was kind of moving around a lot, but he eventually married his hometown sweetheart, Jean Garrigan, on June 7th, 1943. Marion was scheduled to go to the Pacific Theater, but a guy named Arky Langston went AWOL, which is absent without official leave, so he replaced him and went to Europe. He absolutely hated the Atlantic Ocean and got seasick, just like our last account, Gilbert. Absolutely hated the sea, as a lot of people did. He had no glider training, but they still put him in the 325th. He went to Normandy on June 7th, 1944. So as we kind of talked about in our context earlier, the life of a glider rider was not so sound. His glider got shot down. The glider was going so fast, when they made impact with the ground, dirt was shooting back through the glider. And actually, the nose of the glider broke off, and eventually when they made impact with the ground, the nose fell on top of the lieutenant's hip, and he eventually broke his leg and hip. But Mirren was unconscious for a couple seconds, bloody nose, and other than that, he was fine. Got up, and he was just mad, and he wanted to shoot all the Germans he could, but you know, they told him to relax, you know, regroup, let's go back, regroup. So this is a story that I found was interesting from him, from the book. So, and it reads like this. About the second night, we waded through water over a causeway to rescue 110 paratroopers who were surrounded. I went to get water at this well where the aid station was, and I met my captain, Walter Bishop, at a hedgerow, and he smiled at me. When I got back to my foxhole, they said Bishop had been killed. I thought that was kind of an interesting part, like that's how quick things can happen in war. So, you know, sometimes we see these soldiers get into close relationships with their, you know, their friends and their other troops. But, you know, some soldiers don't want to get, you know, into close relationship with other people because they know the end could be near. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why they don't want to establish these relationships. And then the next part goes, I know the chaplain at the aid station was about beside himself praying over the dying. We just weren't used to such things. I guess we came close to being run over by the Germans that day. The artillery and the mortars scared the hell out of me. One day, we were approaching a road crossing, and I knew the Germans were zeroing in on it, and the line stopped. We were laying in a shallow ditch, and a jeep was coming down the road, and a mortar or artillery shell hit the road right close in front of it, and the jeep ended up running over Hood, who's one of his friends, who was right in front of him. I had seen a culvert we passed getting to this road crossing, and I ran back and got into it until the line started moving again. In the meantime, the little Mexican American corporal over me had been standing next to this building and got hit. I talked to him as he was being taken away on his jeep, but he never came back to the outfit. Another friend of mine also got some shrapnel wounds under his helmet that day. Later, we advanced along a line of German foxholes that I think our artillery airburst and killed them. Anyway, there were 13 of them, and I spit on everyone as I went by. War will bring the hate out in you. I thought that was a very kind of cold-blooded move by him. But I guess the war really does bring out like a certain part of you, and you know, you never want to experience that, but there's really nothing you could do. That's what happened. So in Normandy, he felt like they were always on the move, night and day. They were always in that line marching. One day the line stopped and went into cover to sleep for the night. So they had a guy on guard to wake him up when he was supposed to be waking up. But he actually died that night due to loss of blood. So he was late waking up, and the regiment, you know, got mad at him, and they were forced to run. So now they were forced to move quicker. So they missed time because of him. So they had to go quick. So at the end of the hill, they were running down this hill, and there was a damaged German tank at the bottom, and it only had one tract in it, and it was like in this tall grass, and all you can see was just the grass moving, and the German tank started shooting at the regiment, and Mirren blew up the tank, and was able to, you know, not be hurt or anything. And it actually went through this whole World War II. He went through the whole war without being wounded. Of course, he had many close calls, but he said the roughest part of the war was those 33 days in Normandy without a shave or a bath and a special type of underwear that protected the soldiers from gas attacks. Mm-hmm. He said that was very uncomfortable. But he did survive the war, and he came back to his farm in Iowa and raised three young boys.
Yeah, I think that's the last account you guys have, right? Yes. One of the things I want to point out before we close it out is how gliders get to their location. And we talked about this in the previous podcast, which was on a British glider regiment. So this was the American version. So good back to back. They're towed behind bombers. And so when they're released from that tow cable, there's an eerie silence that they kind of hear just with the wind blowing. And there's a timing that goes on for how they navigate the glider. And like you guys said before, they're essentially just crashing to earth and hoping they don't get down. And then when they're there, like after D-Day, these guys are there for, you know, the next, you know, month almost, fighting tooth and nail, hot, just miserable and with very little relief. And so I'm glad you guys were able to bring these stories to life. And the book, you guys said, what was the title of it again?
Glide to Glory.
Glide to Glory. Who wrote it? Do you have the author's name? Or did you forget that one?
Forgot that one.
We'll put it in the description for the podcast. We'll have the author's name for there if anybody wants to check out Glide for Glory. Do you guys have any closing statements to make, Cameron?
The only thing I have to say is that I think that we've all learned something through the people that we've researched. And I mean, these people were, once again, like I said, like around our age. And I don't think I could ever see myself, you know, fighting in this situation or jumping out of a plane and crashing onto the ground. Like, I could never see myself doing this. So I think the bravery of every soldier that we researched is noted.
Yeah, I agree. I think just the overall, like, their courage and not taking, like, they're taking their negatives and turning it into positives. Like, my first account, Gilbert, he was seasick, but he never like complained. He never said, "Oh, dude, I need to go home," or like he, you know, stuck through it all and was able to fight for his country. Like, I think that it just shows like the determination and the grit of all these people that we talked about today, and how interesting that was for their experience and to share their experiences. It's really interesting, and you know, it's really cool to see them like not give up and continue on with their lives afterwards. And
I feel like I learned a lot researching these people and reading about them. I learned a lot about the war and certain experiences that I think I'll probably want to continue to learn more about, you know, certain aspects of the war, specifics and things of that sort. You know, I think this is a really interesting regiment. I think that all these stories are something that you can learn from. And I think I had a great time filming the podcast.
Awesome. Well, thank you guys, and thanks for the research. And this was Tigers by the Fire, episode 3 of season 4. Thank you for listening.